Let's take a deeper look at the controversial execution that's added fuel to the debate over lethal injection and the death penalty in the U.S. At a Florence, Arizona state prison yesterday, it took almost 2 hours for double murderer Joseph Wood to die after he was injected with a relatively new combination of the sedative midazolam and the narcotic hydromorphone. Wood's death is also drawing comparisons with a prolonged Ohio execution in January and a botched Oklahoma execution in April. So let's turn now to Michael Kiefer, who witnessed the Arizona execution yesterday. He's senior reporter for the Arizona Republic newspaper. Michael, thanks so much for joining us.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Now, before we go on, I should just tell listeners that I'm going to ask you to describe what happened yesterday. It could potentially be graphic and not appropriate for everyone, but tell us, you saw the execution. What happened?
Well, this was the fifth execution I've witnessed, and generally what happens is the condemned person just closes his eyes, goes to sleep, doesn't move a whole lot, maybe a few breaths, and it's over in 10 or 11 minutes. And this execution started that way, and you know, there had been some concern given the incidents, the flawed executions, as the court called them, in Oklahoma and Ohio and Florida. And so Joseph Wood closed his eyes, went to sleep, and I thought, well, maybe it's going to work after all. About 5 minutes in, he opened his mouth once and looked almost like a burp. Then a minute later, again, and then again, and it kept going. And then it started for an hour and a half. He continued to open his mouth in this strange way that many of us described as sort of looking like a fish on land, you know, just sort of mouth opening in an unnatural way, and then you'd see it sort of a spasm go down, his chest would rise, his stomach would contract, and it just kept going.
And it ended up taking almost 2 hours, as we noted earlier. But the thing about this case in particular is that there seems to be some disagreement amongst witnesses about what actually happened. Some say Wood was just gasping for air, as you describe. Others say he was snoring.
Well, basically, what we were seeing, I think, was apnea. You know, I mean, apnea is snoring, and it also can, you know, it closes off your throat. So, I mean, it's a question of semantics. When the doctor would switch on the microphone, I mean, it's a soundproof room. When the doctor would switch on the microphone to say that Wood was still sedated, you could hear it in the background, and it was a definite snoring sound. It was quite loud. It was sucking. It kind of reminded me of the filter in my swimming pool when it starts to suck air.
Yeah.
It's louder than I can imitate, and I've tried a few times. And so, yes, it was a snoring noise, and yes, he was unconscious, and yes, he was sedated. So it's hard to say, you know, what he was feeling.
Well, that remains exactly the question, which is why I understand that Arizona Governor Jan Brewer says she's, quote, concerned by the length of time it took for the administered drug protocol to complete the lawful execution of this double murderer. She's also ordered a full review, but she says she's limiting it to this case.
This execution is not going to change people's minds about the death penalty. You are either for or against capital punishment.
So, Michael, on that note, tell us how this is reverberating around Arizona. Apparently, it's not going to change the law in Arizona, but what's the fallout from what happened yesterday?
Well, clearly, I think this is the last time we're going to see midazolam used in an execution anywhere. You know, this is the crisis in capital punishment right now. The drugs are drying up. The manufacturers don't really want to be known as, you know, we're the company that makes drugs that kill people. You know, they've made these drugs for, you know, they have therapeutic clinical uses. So it becomes more and more difficult. You know, they need a new drug. They need to find out a way to do it. But the thing is that whether he was suffering or not, it was not quick. It was inefficient. You know, execution should be quick and efficient. You know, so I don't think it is. And yes, you know, people will talk about, well, he didn't treat his victims humanely, but they're really two different questions. I really feel for the victims, for their grief, for their anger. You know, and in this case, Wood looked at them and laughed and seemed to scoff. I don't know if it was deliberately mocking or if it was ironic or what. And so they have full reason to be angry. The two people who were there witnessed the deaths of their loved ones.
Right. Well, Michael Kiefer is senior reporter for the Arizona Republic. He witnessed the prolonged execution yesterday of double murderer Joseph Wood. He's speaking to us from Phoenix. Michael, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Former Florida Governor Jeb Bush is urging his fellow Republicans to get behind immigration reform. In an op-ed in the Wall Street Journal today, Bush and a co-author say the current crisis along the border with Mexico should not be used as an excuse for inaction, not passing an immigration package. As for the surge in unaccompanied children from Central America, Jeb Bush says the vast majority of them should be sent home. Well, right now we're going to meet a young man who overstayed a tourist visa in the U.S. and has decided on his own to return home to Mexico. You could say he decided to self-deport. From the Here and Now Contributors Network, KUOW's Liz Jones has his story.
Dozens of neckties drape across the couch. Jorge Lerma sets a few dozen aside. The rest he tosses on the giveaway pile. Jorge rents a tiny room at this house near Seattle. The landlord has popped in to look for some bargains.
Wow.
Jorge sells him a television and a tripod. The discard pile shrinks a bit, but on top of it, there still sits a crisp 5-foot American flag. Jorge used to hang it in his room.
I used to love the U.S. I used to love this country. So I used to have a flag, and I always wanted to be an American. Yeah, but things didn't work out.
So now you don't want it anymore?
Yeah, I don't want it anymore.
Jorge will leave Seattle in a few hours. The landlord pats him on the shoulder and says good luck. Jorge's from a middle-class family in Mexico, but as a teen, he craved life in the U.S.
Like, I used to watch all these shows on cable TV, you know, like Baywatch and Beverly Hills.
He came here alone on a tourist visa and overstayed it by about 15 years. He's 32 now. Jorge graduated high school in California. Then his dad helped pay for college at Cal State Los Angeles, where he got a degree in electrical engineering. But it's a degree he can't use here because of his illegal status.
Like more like way over here, like that.
On Facebook, nice. Jorge flips through his college photos, remembering some good times.
Got me rock climbing, preparing to run a marathon.
In the photos, Jorge is tan, fit, and smiling. What's shocking is now, 6 years after college, he looks dramatically different. These past years have taken a toll. While his friends landed engineering jobs, Jorge struck out. He moved to Washington in 2010, hopeful about a better job market. Here, he worked in construction and at a warehouse. He injured his back and shoulder. He stopped playing sports. He lost 30 pounds. And his face is blotchy and red from rosacea. It's a condition often triggered by stress.
I feel like I'm stuck in the same place. I feel like I'm a fish in an aquarium, but I can't swim. I'm like sinking and sinking. And the other fishes are like swimming and moving on.
Jorge's fought depression as reality has set in. The engineering career he wants can't happen here.
All these years, all this work, and it's kind of, it failed. It was like a failure.
Bye, Carlos.
Just a few days before, Jorge dropped into a student club at the University of Washington to say goodbye to a few friends. He shared his decision with the whole group.
I'm just like at a point where, first of all, I'm broke, and second, I'm just tired. You know, I've been waiting for immigration reform for the 10, 12 years. They've been saying that, oh, it's coming, you know, it's next year or the year after that.
Immigration reform hasn't happened. But President Obama did approve a program that gives so-called dreamers like Jorge temporary waivers to live and work in the U.S. Jorge misses the age cutoff by just 6 months.
Yay.
At the student club, Jorge's comment sent a chill through the room. Like him, these students are all undocumented, with lives firmly rooted here in the U.S. In Mexico City, Jill Anderson researches this phenomenon of young people who return home, and she sees a top reason for those who voluntarily make this choice.
They're fed up.
And they're fed up in an increasingly globalized world where they're realizing, well, you know, maybe all the options are not here in the United States. Why don't I go back to Mexico where I at least have citizenship and try to study there, work there?
Anderson's analyzed Mexican census data and found an increasing trend of young Mexicans aged 15 to 32 returning to their homeland. She estimates about 500,000 people in this age group returned from 2005 to 2010. And a report from the Pew Hispanic Center shows the number of overall returnees to Mexico doubled in the past decade. Anderson's written a book about these young returnees and if they're finding a better life back in Mexico.
No, I would say overall it's an extremely challenging experience. Sometimes they find, you know, family here in Mexico, but often those ties have been, you know, weakened or most of the family is, in fact, in the United States and they find themselves here alone.
Two overstuffed suitcases. That's all Jorge plans to carry with him back to Mexico. He'll take some clothes, important papers, and his Mariners baseball cap, even though he never made it to a game. He rolls the suitcases up the driveway to the truck he just sold to a friend.
I just don't know, like, what's going to happen, you know? It's like driving, but someone tells you, like, close your eyes. I feel like I'm going blind to Mexico because I don't know what's going to happen. Like, to be honest, I don't know.
For Here and Now, I'm Liz Jones in Seattle.
There are now 102 days left until the midterm elections, and a bitter primary battle came to an end this week in Georgia when David Perdue was declared the winner of the state's Republican Senate primary. He's going to face Democratic candidate Michelle Nunn in November. And it's the last primary we'll hear about for a couple weeks. There is a lull until August 5th when there will be primaries in Kansas, Michigan, Missouri, and Washington. But that doesn't mean there will be a lull in our district profiles. In our weekly look at congressional races around the country, we turn now to New York's 19th congressional district. Incumbent Chris Gibson, who's a Republican, will try to keep his job away from challenger Democrat Sean Eldridge. Joining us now is Allison Dunn. She's Hudson Valley Bureau Chief at WAMC Northeast Public Radio. Allison, welcome.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, first, tell us a little bit about this district.
Well, the district changed in 2012 because there was redistricting from the 2010 census. So the new district leans Republican. There are two counties that are Democratic. One is actually where Sean Eldridge resides, Ulster County. And the other is Columbia County, where Chris Gibson resides, though it's very, very slight. And those are numbers from 2012.
And what are the big jobs in the district? What kind of industry is there?
Well, you know, it really varies. It's a very, very big district. There are 11 counties, 165 towns. So it varies. There's farming. There are cities like Kingston in Ulster County. There's Sullivan County where, you know, it's a very depressed area at the moment. It is all over the place. You have universities like SUNY New Paltz where you have 3D manufacturing. That's a big technology coming into play.
All right. Well, let's get to the candidates. We've got Republican incumbent Chris Gibson. I want to listen to a little bit of him. Here he is speaking about immigration reform and this flood of migrants on your station, WAMC. He wants changes to the immigration system. And once that's done, he says,
then you have to deal with the 11 million people that are here now. And we are a nation of laws and we're a nation of immigrants, and we need to find a way to reconcile the two. I believe the way to do that is to allow those that are in the country now, undocumented, an opportunity to plead guilty. They pass a background check, they pay a fine, tantamount to back taxes, and some say learn English, but then there would be a path to legal status.
And Allison, that sounds like a bit of a more centrist view on immigration than some of his Republican colleagues in the House.
It is. He did not like the Senate bill, though. It's not something he would have voted for in the House had House Speaker John Boehner brought it to the floor. He says that the House is working on another bill, but he doesn't know the details. He won't comment on it. You know, both he and Sean Eldridge stand in some of the same places on immigration, not all. There are a lot of farms in the 19th Congressional District, so they'd really like to see a guest worker farm program included in the bill. And they both are calling it a humanitarian crisis. So it's just the path to get to the solution is a bit different. Sean Eldridge does not want to see Band-Aid solutions and wants to see something more comprehensive like the Senate bill, which he said was not perfect, but something he would have voted for.
Well, and we know that in addition to immigration, foreign policy has also come up in this campaign. Democrat Sean Eldridge, who is 27 years old, gave an interview also to your station. He recently addressed the conflict in Israel and Gaza. Let's listen to that.
I think Israel definitely has a right to defend itself, but I hope we will have a ceasefire. And, you know, it's what's frightening to me now, too, is technology is playing a bit of a role here. There were Hamas and Hezbollah, and I think both now have drones, and they have drones that can fly over Israel and over civilian areas. So I think there's a very real threat to Israeli security. At the end of the day, we need a two-state solution.
Allison, is that issue, what's happening in Israel and Gaza, something that's important in this race?
You know, it could be, because it's kind of happened recently. I mean, it's an ongoing issue, but the escalation is recent, and it could be. Well, we're just going to have to see how that plays out.
What are the other issues that are important to Sean Eldridge?
Fracking. He is anti-hydraulic fracturing, and Gibson is pro, but with caveats. He wants to make sure there are environmental protections and things of that nature. However, it's been kind of interesting lately because Sean Eldridge is married to Facebook co-founder Chris Hughes. It's where the independent wealth comes from for his race. And his husband's investments, it has been found, include companies that do fracking. So that has been brought to Eldridge's attention, and he has said, well, listen, I don't pay attention to everything that's in that investment portfolio. It's done by a third party, and I don't, you know, oversee it day to day.
Is there a lot of outside money coming into this race?
Well, interestingly, Sean Eldridge is not accepting money from corporate PACs, and he is matching contributions penny for penny. So most of his contributions have come from individuals $50 or less across the district. And they're fairly even when it comes to what's in their, you know, their coffers. And of course, Chris Gibson will accept corporate PAC money. In fact, House Speaker John Boehner was in Sullivan County last summer for a fundraiser for Gibson. It was the first time a House speaker reportedly ever visited Sullivan County, though not the first fundraiser that Boehner has done for Gibson. And that raised a lot of money. So that helped him, you know, kind of get off, because he knew from the get-go, I'm going to have to match this super wealthy young guy who's running against me. We're going to need a lot of money. That August event, by the way, raised $100,000 for Gibson's re-election campaign. And Gibson has painted Eldridge as a carpetbagger who, with no ties to the district. Now, Eldridge and Hughes moved into Ulster County last year, beginning of last year. And, you know, they have a lovely home. And Sean Eldridge has set up, he has an investment fund called Hudson River Ventures in the city of Kingston in Ulster County. He's done a lot for businesses in the area. And he says, I do have ties. I sit on various boards. Conversely, Chris Gibson is a lifelong resident of Columbia County. So he grew up around the corner where he lives present day. Retired Army colonel, so he does have a lot of ties to the community. But again, Eldridge deflecting calls about being a carpetbagger.
Allison Dunn, Hudson Valley Bureau Chief at WAMC, Northeast Public Radio in New York State, talking with us about the 19th Congressional District in New York. Allison, thank you.
Thank you, Jeremy.
Well, from upstate New York now to Springfield, we've got this news.
There's a cyber cafe opening right here in Springfield. Will you take me, Dad, please? I'll show you how to order pizza over the internet.
The internet? Is that thing still around?
That is, of course, the Springfield of The Simpsons, which celebrates its 25th anniversary this year with what may be the largest syndication deal in television history. Not only has FX Network secured broadcast rights for its FXX cable channel, this October it's also launching The Simpsons World. Every Simpsons episode ever made, that's 552 and counting, available online on demand. But if you're thinking practically everything is on demand anyway, what's the big deal? Well, the database will be searchable by scene and subject and available on any internet-connected device a subscriber owns.
So you're telling me that if I want to, for example, watch the scene where Bart is on Kids News,
yep,
maybe I could just search for Zing, Zork, and Kapowza, the three words that they use to describe his raw talent as a journalist?
Pretty much. And if I search for my favorite character, Sideshow Bob, and by subject, let's say politics, I'd get this.
Because you need me, Springfield. Your guilty conscience may force you to vote Democratic, but deep down inside you secretly long for a cold-hearted Republican to lower taxes, brutalize criminals, and rule you like a king. That's why I did this. to protect you from yourselves.
Well, we all may need to be protected from ourselves, since who knows how many hours we might waste searching for the funniest and most obscure moments when The Simpsons World comes out this fall.
Well, and I'm just thinking, 552 episodes, they're 30 minutes each. If you calculate that, it comes out to just about 12 days, nonstop, morning, noon, and night, to play all those Simpsons episodes. When the St. Louis Rams open their NFL training camp tomorrow, there will be a lot of eyes on Michael Sam. The defensive end is the first openly gay player ever drafted by a professional football team, and recent comments by former NFL coach Tony Dungy have only added to the attention that will be focused on Sam. Dungy, who is now an analyst for NBC, told the Tampa Tribune he would not have drafted Sam, saying he, quote, wouldn't want to deal with all of it. It's not going to be totally smooth. Things will happen, end quote. Here and Now sports analyst Mike Pesca hosts the podcast The Gist at Slate.com. He's back with us from New York. Mike, what do you think Dungy is talking about there, saying things will happen?
Well, I think he just means in terms of a distraction. And this is a statement, or this is a word that people in the NFL, coaches, people in the front office come back to again and again and again. It's going to be a distraction. And when I press people, not just on this, but in the past, people talk, you know, Tim Tebow was a distraction. Well, what does that mean? Where is it, like two fewer plays that you're not going to be able to run through in practice? Is it a lack of mental energy that you're not going to be able to devote? And no one could quite define it. It's just this general sense, especially among non-star players, that they shouldn't be interviewed, that they shouldn't be paid attention to. How will it hurt the team? No one really knows how it will hurt the team, but they all agree it will be, and here's the word again, a distraction.
Well, and the Rams coach, Jeff Fisher, has said it's absolutely not a distraction.
Well, I think maybe it is a distraction, but they are in the business of drawing attention and getting people to go to their games. So if they don't want a distraction, maybe the NFL should never do any interviews. I mean, people are going to pay attention to them. More people will pay attention to this seventh-round draft pick than just about any other seventh-round draft pick ever. He's going to sell more jerseys as a guy who is not a starter or not even maybe a second stringer than probably anyone has ever done. But that's not a bad thing, right? So I understand that Tony Dungy tried to walk back his comments, didn't want to offend anyone, wanted to give the impression that Michael Sam deserves a chance, even though in his original comments he said, I wouldn't want him on my team. So Tony Dungy is literally saying, here's a guy who deserves a chance, I just don't want to be the one to give him the chance.
Well, and here's Tony Dungy, by the way, on the Dan Patrick radio show this week. He was asked whether his faith, because he's a devout Christian, has anything to do with his opinion of Michael Sam. Let's listen to what he said.
You know, gay marriage and who should be on a football team have nothing to do with each other. To equate this to gay marriage, to me, is really silly.
Mike Pesca, how is Michael Sam handling this?
Well, Michael Sam, I guess you could say he took the high road. He really just tweeted a couple things, which was, thank God Tony Dungy isn't the St. Louis Rams coach, he said laughingly, because, you know, the implication being that I wouldn't have been drafted. And then he simply said, like everyone else in America, everyone's entitled to their opinions. Michael Sam is smart enough. And I'm not saying he's been orchestrating some great media push, but he's gotten most of the big things right, and he's smart enough not to pick an unnecessary fight with a guy with the credentials of Tony Dungy and also with the outlet, because that NBC show is the number one rated show. So why get into a fight with Tony Dungy? Let Tony Dungy say what he wants. Let Tony Dungy have his opinions. And just to go back to the gay marriage thing, you know, he has campaigned against or supported people who are against gay marriage. Tony Dungy, you know, always points to his faith as a reason he's against gay marriage. So it's hard not to think, even if not consciously within Tony Dungy, that Michael Sam being gay is not something that Tony Dungy approves of. And if you want to contrast it with Tim Tebow, who was certainly a distraction but also a born-again Christian, Tony Dungy embraced him and said, I hope you make it. So there's a little difference there.
Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst, who hosts the daily podcast The Gist at Slate.com. And of course, some people are actually going to be just watching Michael Sam on the field as this training camp gets underway. Mike, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton was on NPR's On Point program today and said the reset with Russia worked. That's what Clinton had called the Obama administration's fresh relationship with Russia several years ago. And given today's headlines, many have said it clearly did not work. Here's Clinton speaking this morning.
The reset worked. It was an effort to try to obtain Russian cooperation on some key objectives, while Medvedev was president, and of course Putin still, you know, pulled the strings, but he gave Medvedev a certain amount of independence to negotiate, number one, a new arms control treaty, which was absolutely necessary. We brought Russia around to understanding why we thought there needed to be international sanctions against Iran. I'll never forget the meeting that we had, the president and I, and just one other person on our side, and Medvedev and two on his side, where we told him that we had evidence, conclusive evidence, about Iran building an underground facility at a place called Fordow. The Russians were shocked because they thought they knew what was going on in Iran. So we brought them to the table at the Security Council. We got those tough sanctions, and we eventually were able to get to the negotiations that are going on now with the hope that something real can come out of them.
That's former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton speaking today on NPR's On Point program. You can link to the full interview at our website, hereandnow.org.
This week, two federal appeals court panels made rulings on the subsidies available to some people who sign up for insurance through the federal health care exchange. We'll revisit that issue in a moment. But now we're also learning that people have been using that federal exchange much more than expected since the deadline back in April for open enrollment. There have been nearly a million transactions since then. That's from federal data released to the independent news organization ProPublica yesterday. And joining us now is Charles Ornstein. He's senior reporter at ProPublica, and he's talking to us from the NPR's studios in New York. Hi there, Charles.
Hey, Magda.
So when we talk about the federal exchange, we're talking about healthcare.gov. We had some 5 million signups by the time open enrollment ended in April, but there have been these almost 1 million transactions since then. What are we talking about when we say transactions?
Well, healthcare.gov handles all the insurance enrollments for 36 states, and these are big states like Texas and Florida and Illinois, which didn't set up their own state exchanges. And when open enrollment closed, it essentially was the end of the sort of free period by which anybody could sign up for insurance under the Affordable Care Act. It's an annual sort of period of time. So what's happened since then is that people are still eligible to make changes to their insurance if they have life events, if they get married or if they get divorced, if they lose a job or get a job, if they have a baby. And those folks are going and continuing to use the site. I think some people thought that the level of activity would be really low. But a million transactions means that people have gone in and changed their insurance or signed up for new insurance since the end of open enrollment, so since April 19th.
So it could be changes or it could be new enrollments, but we don't know how many of those million are new enrollments specifically.
It is frustrating that the government has not released any information about any sort of enrollment activity after the end of open enrollment. What an insurance industry official told me was that less than half of that 960,000 represent new enrollments, but that's still, you know, about 480,000 new enrollments, which is not an insignificant number.
Right. So was this a surprise to you and those who follow the Affordable Care Act so closely that there would be this level of activity after open enrollment ended in April?
I think it is. I think that the assumption was that while many people qualified to make changes, not many of those people would. People may, you know, wait a little longer in hopes of getting a new job, or they may have procrastinated in terms of making a change a change to their insurance. But the fact that they are doing that indicates that behind the scenes, the site remains very active. I thought it was really interesting, in fact, that more transactions happened on the site in June than did in November, which was one of the troublesome months for the exchange, but still right in the peak of open enrollment.
Right. It's interesting because these numbers, in a way, they actually raise even more questions about how Americans are using what's available to them through the Affordable Care Act. Because as you report, the Obama administration hasn't released details of how many consumers, for example, failed to pay their premiums and were maybe dropped by their health insurance plans, which matters because there's still this remaining question about whether new members signing up after April would offset that attrition rate.
Yeah, absolutely. There are so many questions, and it makes it hard for folks to sort of make a definitive judgment on the success or failure of the Affordable Care Act when we don't know some of the basic bits of information. And so in this case, last fall, when the website healthcare.gov was having so many troubles, the administration was releasing next to no information. And so we put in a Freedom of Information Act request, just find out what was the daily activity like on this site. And just to show you how long it takes to process those requests, it took more than 6 months. It took more than 8 months for us to get back this request, this week, yesterday.
Wow, quite a long period of time. Now, Charlie, as we mentioned in the introduction to this conversation, these numbers we're talking about are for people on the federal exchange, and these are the same Americans who are in question regarding those two federal appeals court rulings from earlier this week. Because one of the panels ruled that these individuals were not eligible for insurance subsidies from the federal government. Another panel ruled that they were. So does this additional activity that we've been seeing after April have any impact or could change anything regarding where that we stand on the issue of the legality of the subsidies?
Well, pity the poor consumer, right? Just trying to understand and get through their day and understand the way that this law affects them. Here, as you said, you have two powerful courts coming to diametrically opposite conclusions. But one thing is clear, and right, so if there's one takeaway from this, it's that as these legal machinations go on, nothing is happening right now to these subsidies. People can still sign up for policies if they're eligible and get the subsidies, and people who have the subsidies as of right now can keep the subsidies. So that is the one definite amid all of this legal morass.
In the last couple seconds that we have, any news on those state exchanges? Because we've been focusing on the federal exchange right now.
Some states had a lot more luck than others during this open enrollment cycle. California and New York performed really well. Colorado did pretty well. And others had so many problems, like Maryland and Connecticut. Those states are still trying to figure out how to right the ship for the year ahead.
Wow. So lots of news ongoing with the Affordable Care Act.
No question.
And as you report, last thing to note, open enrollment begins again on November 15th. So
get ready.
Charles Ornstein, he's a senior reporter at ProPublica. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Some sad news today about a young aviator. A 17-year-old from Indiana died yesterday when his single-engine plane crashed shortly after taking off from American Samoa. Horace Suleiman was aiming to become the youngest person to pilot a single-engine plane around the globe. His father, who was with him, is also missing. Earlier this month, though, a similar journey had a happy ending. A 31-year-old named Amelia Earhart became the youngest woman ever to fly a single-engine aircraft around the world. And in doing so, she symbolically completed her namesake's flight. We talked to her in June before she took off and caught up with her again earlier this week. I started by asking her how it felt to have completed this flight that she had dreamed about and worked toward for so long.
You know, it was a pretty amazing experience. It took a year and a half to plan, and it's pretty daunting to look at a big world map, map out the route, and just go for it. But that's what it took. And you know, that's what Amelia did back in the 1930s. And she certainly had it a lot more difficult without the use of internet and, you know, all the fast-paced world that we have. But when it came right down to it, we planned the flight from Oakland. We went through 14 countries, traveled 28,000 miles, and it was a great flight. All in all, we covered a lot of ground and met some amazing people along the way.
When you said to us that you were most looking forward to the leg over the South Pacific where Amelia Earhart disappeared 77 years ago, what was it like when you actually got there?
So we flew over Howland Island at 27,000 feet. It was pretty mind-blowing to see the tiny space that she was looking for in the middle of the South Pacific. And Howland Island is basically just an atoll out in the middle of the ocean. It's less than a mile across. The government built a runway specifically for Amelia's flight back in the 30s, and she was set to land there after leaving Papua New Guinea. And so when we looked out the window and I offset the aircraft just a bit to the left of the island so that I could circle around and have it out my window, you know, I was filled with adrenaline when we flew over, and it was definitely an emotional moment because I felt it was the closest that I had come to my namesake at that point in time. And I was scrambling with cameras and trying to, you know, really take in the moment, and I finally just set everything down. And I just stared at that space because that's what Amelia wanted to see with every part of her. She wanted to land safely on that island, but she was never able to do that. So at that point in the flight, you know, it became our mission to complete the flight for her and carry her legacy safely back to Oakland.
Were there any scary moments along the way?
Then, you know, there weren't any scary moments in the air. The aircraft performed perfectly, no squawks the entire time, totally safe there. But on the ground, there were some scary moments, you know, when you're met by officers who are armed, who look entirely different from you. You know, it's very difficult to communicate. It takes a deep breath and a good look in the eye to really come to terms with someone and show them that you're there with good intentions and that you're there for the right reasons.
Like, where was that moment when you got off the plane and you had to deal with people who were armed and didn't speak your language?
Sao Tome was one of those places, and that's a tiny island off the west coast of Africa. And essentially, we got there, and I looked out the window, and I saw a group of about 10 men, none of which were smiling, and I popped the door open on the airplane, and none of them looked me in the eye. Hmm. And that came down to them being very surprised that there was a woman piloting an aircraft. And when we got off the plane, my co-pilot, Shane Jordan, was pretty much the only one they would speak to. Every bit of communication was done with Shane, who, of course, was a male. And so I decided to step forward, you know, shake their hand, say, hello, I'm the captain, Amelia Earhart, and, you know, we need to fuel up. And it was a good lesson in just how far we still need to go with women in aviation, not only in the U.S., but worldwide.
Well, and where did you stay in these places?
I'll admit, not everywhere we stayed was very nice. We stayed in some pretty broken down spots, concrete floors, very limited, bathroom facilities, and a lot of bugs, a lot of insects, a lot of cracks in the walls. But that's what it was about. You know, it was about having an adventure. It wasn't about staying in a cush hotel all the way around the world. It was, you know, taking that airplane to some pretty exotic places and experiencing things that I, for one, never had.
How closely did you follow Amelia Earhart's original route from back 77 years ago?
I carried it through as closely as I possibly could. We were able to match up 10 of our locations to the original Amelia flight. And a couple things changed where we went. One of those was geopolitical situations across Africa and the Middle East, where we just had to avoid certain spots where we're not allowed to land as U.S. citizens. And also heading through the Middle East, you know, would have increased the danger of the flight significantly. We also stayed out of India heading through Mumbai because it's monsoon season. But our route, when you lay one route on top of the other, it's tough to differentiate the two. We got pretty close.
Well, and you posted some gorgeous photos of sunrises and sunsets and the earth and sea from above, and we'll put some of those at our website, hereandnow.org. But what was the most beautiful part of the trip?
You know, it's hard to say because, you know, seeing the entire globe around the world and seeing those sunrises with the magnificent colors was just breathtaking. But one of the spots that sticks out to me are the sand dunes along the east coast of Brazil. And as we track down from Trinidad and Tobago, there's a beautiful sand field that's developed right along the coastline. And during high tide, the water comes in and fills up these tiny lakes. So there was this beautiful grid of turquoise water on white sand beaches just for miles and miles. So that's one spot that stuck out to me. Same with Kilimanjaro. Seeing that from 2,000 feet as we broke through the cloud layer, as we departed out, heading over Kenya, out of Tanzania, was just a stunning view because the mountain is snow-capped. And as you're flying over Africa, you know, you don't expect to see those colors. We saw a lot of volcanoes from the ground, some of which were active. And as we flew through, the transition between, you know, the different types of shorelines and going from jungle to desert, flying over the Amazon, was just stunning. And those pictures are something that I'll treasure for the rest of my life.
Now, you had a photo of Amelia Earhart in the cockpit with you throughout the flight. Do you feel more connected to her now after completing this?
I do. And the thing is, you know, a year ago, I found out that I wasn't related to Amelia after thinking for the first 30 years of my life that I was. And that took a real tough turn for me. It was, you know, do I continue on with this flight around the world, knowing that there's no blood relation at this point? And when I decided to move forward, I thought, well, I'm either going to have, you know, a distinct separation from Amelia and her legacy, or it's going to become stronger than anything I've ever known. And luckily the latter happened. And we did have that small black and white print of Amelia there in our cockpit. And she just kind of floated around the plane, you know, throughout the whole trip. And I gained so much more respect for her upon completion, and especially after passing over Howland Island, because seeing how tiny that island was in such a vast ocean, she was really much, much more brave than I ever knew. And I've always had so much respect for her and known that she was an incredible woman. But seeing what she was doing with the lack of technology back in the 1930s, not only the actual flight was difficult, but the planning process as well. I mean, it took me a year and a half, and I've got internet at my fingertips. She was doing everything by way of mail.
Well, and after doing that planning for a year and a half, and not just that, but having such a long time where you thought you were related to Amelia Earhart, then you realized you weren't, then you've done this flight. What do you do now? What is next for you?
You know, it's wonderful that I had already started the Fly with Amelia Foundation, because that's where my heart is at. And that's what the true passion and excitement around Amelia's life was. You know, she said back in the 1930s that the reason she was flying was to create opportunities for the women who will fly tomorrow's planes. And that's exactly who I am. So now that I've strengthened that connection, I feel like I've completed a huge goal for myself and taken my confidence level to a whole new zone, now I can grow the foundation and give other women the opportunity to fly. We awarded 10 flight scholarships flying over Howland Island. As we made our way through, we announced them on Twitter. So we've got high school age girls getting out to the airport and experiencing what I feel when I get into the plane and what Amelia felt when she climbed into her Lockheed Electra. So what's next? You know, another strong woman with a great experience under her belt who can now go out and lead by example and hopefully influence a lot of young girls.
Amelia Rose Earhart, who recently became the youngest woman to fly around the world in a single-engine aircraft. Thank you so much for speaking with us. Congratulations on completing this.
Thank you very much.